Hey everybody, it's your old pal James from the future here. What's this, James from the future, I hear you asking? Is it my birthday? Is it Christmas? Is it my birthday and Christmas? There was a special episode of Monster Mania just last week. This is supposed to be a Patron Deities week. Yeah, it's right, it is. And there is going to be an episode of Patron Deities. But I've run into a little problem. Every other week I try to put out a special episode, each one of them requested by one of my $5 level patrons. Obviously, that means that there should be 26 $5 level patron specials every year. But I've got more than 26 $5 level patrons now. In fact, I've got a good number more than 26. So I'm going to have to start increasing the frequency of special episodes. That's more content for you every week, free, gratis, and for nothing. Unless, of course, you are one of the aforementioned $5 level patrons, in which case, thank you very much. But so, basically, whenever I can, I'm going to try and fit in an extra patron special every other week. And hopefully, by doing that, I should make my way through the list of patrons. By my calculations, I should get them done by the end of the summer, but we'll see how it goes. Anyway. The upshot is just that there's going to be more special episodes coming out for a while, and I hope you enjoy them. Monster Man, special episode, Other Golems. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters, and in particular by Patreon backer William, who has asked me to talk about other types of golem. Now, we've already had a special episode on the Golem, that is the story of the Golem of Prague. And way, way, way back in episode 25, more than 250 episodes ago, yikes, I talked about the weird category structure of golems in the Monster Manual, in that this is essentially an artificial category created out of four monsters that don't really have that much to do with each other. In this episode, I'll ask the question, or do they? And look at the other things that might be considered a golem, and kind of how to use the principles that we can infer from this categorization to create fun golem monsters for your fantasy RPGs. If you'd like to be like William and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to the rewards given to patrons at other pledge levels, you'll also get to choose a bonus episode. So William, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy your episode. So let's quickly review what we've covered about golems so far. The name golem comes from the story of the Golem of Prague, and it means something like raw material. The story of the Golem of Prague tells of a rabbi who created a man from clay, leading to all kinds of misadventures. Now, in Dungeons & Dragons, what happens is that multiple types of monsters become combined to form a general category of golem. So the Monster Manual gives us the clay golem, which is the golem that we're all familiar with, plus the flesh golem, which is basically Frankenstein's monster, the stone golem, which is basically a sort of animated statue, and the iron golem, which is basically Talos the Man of Bronze from whichever Ray Harryhausen film Talos the Man of Bronze is in. I mean, that's not what he's from, but that's the version that we're looking at here. I realize I've just sacrificed some of my old school credentials by getting my Ray Harryhausen films mixed up, but I really do struggle with them. This is very unusual because normally what we see in Dungeons & Dragons is that, particularly in very early Dungeons & Dragons, is that the game takes things that are basically the same and splits them into ever smaller categories, as witness the literally probably a dozen different mischievous woodland or farmyard sprites that are all basically the same thing. From the Boggart to the Bacon to the Calmulis, they're all more or less the same mischievous fairy. Here we see different monsters being combined into a category, and this trend is going to continue. So taking a look at this original categorization, what do these monsters have in common? Well, first, they are artificial creations. Second, they resemble a human in some way. Third, they're ambiguously sentient. They're ambiguously alive. I think also, and this is something I want to return to, at least the original ones are typically singular, right? The Golem of Prague, Frankenstein's monster, Talos the Man of Bronze. Generally speaking, they are individual creations rather than the kind of like horde effect that you get with something like skeletons or zombies or, you know, in later science fictional things, robots. Now, those rules are not consistent as the game develops. There are no additional golem types in Fiendfolio or Monster Manual 2, but retroactively, second edition decided that there were. So in the Monstrous Manual, a number of other monsters are brought within the category of Golem, including gargoyles, scarecrows, necrophidii, and caryatids, pillar ladies. So there the focus seems to be specifically on the artificiality of the Golem. Anything that is an artificial construct, and specifically including the necrophidius, which, remember, although it is made from bones, is not an undead creature. It's an artificial bone construct. Those all fall within the category of golems. And really, only a few new types are added, notably one based on the Terracotta Army of Qin Shi Huangdi. Those are funerary effigies in a tomb from Qin Dynasty China, and they're clay models sculpted in the likeness of warriors. And so there, these are treated as, you know, golems that you could include as well, which I quite like. There are also robots in Old Mage. D&D golems have frequently been developed further into being essentially robots, and that makes sense because we have a lot of the same anxieties about them as we do about robots, although there are some different ones. So the fundamental question of things like the Golem of Prague or Frankenstein's monster is, you know, to what extent is this thing human? It's human-like? Is it completely human? What rights does it have? What responsibilities does its creator have to it? You know, Frankenstein's monster is angry because he was abandoned by his creator, and although he does monstrous things, you can't read Frankenstein and not think, well, he does kind of have a point about what a bad dude Victor Frankenstein is. So we have curious feelings about things that are like, but not the same as, humans. We're fascinated by them, but they're also a little uncanny. That's something that we also have about robots. Robots, of course, also are a locus for our concerns about industrialization, mechanization, about mankind's relationship to technology. That's generally not true with golems, which, as we said earlier, tend to be individual, right? The story of the Golem of Prague is about one rabbi whose skills are so great that he can do this, as opposed to a bazillion golems being stamped out in a factory. That's a creative difference in portrayals. In general, I don't tend to like robo-golems, but we can talk about them a little bit at the end. So we're talking about creatures where the essence of them is, to some extent, their artificiality and their relationship to humanity. A lot of the symbolism employed with golems comes from their material. So when we think of a clay golem, we specifically think of this idea of rough, raw materials, crude. You know, clay often symbolizes kind of primitive and fragile. We say that an idol has feet of clay. Talk about the human body being clay. Priests and fools say we are but animate clay. And that's different from the implacable endurance implied by the stone golem, or the deadly warlike nature of the iron golem. The material that the golem is made from gives us the symbolic palette that we're going to be working with when we create a golem monster. One example of this would be the Horde Golem, which was the subject of the My Favorite Monster episode that I recorded with Zach Cox. You should go back and check that out if you haven't. It's an example of a golem formed from a dragon's treasure hoard. And again, because we have existing symbolic connotations that are attached to gold and treasure, it all makes perfect sense. So I quickly thought of all the golem monsters that sprang to mind. I've got a list of five here. Some of these are from later editions of D&D. Some of them are from scenarios. Some of them are just from miniatures that I have seen. I don't think any that I actually have. And one is from the special episode that I made about Doctor Who monsters, right? It was the candy golem, the Bertie Bassett character from Happiness Patrol. So let's go through each of these in turn and see what their materials and their presentation say about them. So my list reads, the first monster that I put on my list is the stained glass golem. Now this is, I think this appears in D&D 2nd edition, but it's exactly what it looks like. It's kind of an animated stained glass image. And so I think that the power of this comes from the idea of stained glass windows as representing the sacred to us, because you find them in churches. There's nothing about stained glass that should make it particularly sacred, but one way that an object can acquire symbolic associations is where you typically see it. Which is why symbolism is different from culture to culture, right? So the stained glass golem has images of sacredness. I would expect to find it in, say, the ruins of a temple. Or indeed maybe in a not ruined temple. It's also glass, and glass has very different feeling about it than, say, stone. So I would expect the stained glass golem's attacks to be razor sharp. It'd be really frightening. Again, because most of us are more likely to cut ourselves on some broken glass than we are to get biffed with a big rock. I mean, it depends what you do for a living, I suppose, but there's a certain visceral horror to being slashed with glass. There's also the idea of a stained glass golem as a broken glass golem. So maybe the stained glass golem is like a figure of a saint that detaches itself from the window that it's in and goes out, you know, slashing people with its glass crozier or whatever. Alternatively, it could be made from the remnants of broken stained glass windows. There's churches in Norwich, I want to say, where they've taken stained glass windows that were broken out of the buildings, maybe in World War II, but maybe some other time, I don't know, and, you know, kind of made these new patterns out of them. You know, so maybe it's just a grinding, clashing, clacking mess of different broken glass shards. And it gives us a very different feel than the image of the stained glass figure attacking somebody. There is definitely a movie in which a figure comes out of a stained glass window and attacks somebody, maybe in a nightmare, and I don't remember what it is. Next, I have on the list Shipwreck Golem. Now, I know that this is based on a miniature. It's a Reaper miniature, the Shipwreck Golem. And this is, of course, an undersea golem made of the different parts of broken ships that have settled down there over the years. And it's all encrusted with seaweed and barnacles. And I think it's got an anchor for one hand. You know, just a terrific image. Again, the Shipwreck Golem is really effective because it uses the idea of a human construct turned deadly, right? A ship is a thing that we build to keep us safe from the elements, to transport us across the waves. And yet, of course, it can also be a sailor's grave because the ship, I mean, it's really the sea that kills you, but it can feel like the ship betrayed you, it turned on you. And so the image of a shipwreck is a deadly thing brought to life. Also, again, we see the image of the shipwreck and we're very conditioned to think of it as an image of loss and mystery and loneliness. And so when we then turn that into an ambulant thing, is much more a shipwreck golem has greater visual power, more of a memorable image than a broken down barn golem or even a burned down house golem, even though they're both just sources of timber that you could make your timber golem out of. One of them means something in a way that the other doesn't. Ship is already a deadly construct. You can say the same thing for the graveyard golem, which is made up of like gravestones, walls, the railings. For some reason, people tend to associate spiked railings with graveyards, and yet there are spiked railings everywhere. But never mind. Images are images, and they don't have to necessarily make sense. I like this one because there was a recent discussion on Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff about what makes things creepy as opposed to frightening. And it's to do with the idea of things being ambiguously threatening. So graveyards aren't dangerous places, but they remind us of things that we would prefer not to be reminded of. They remind us of people we cared about who died. They remind us of the fact that we are going to die, and we don't like that. So there's something uncanny about graveyards. You could not believe in ghosts. You could be an absolute materialist. You could have only fond associations of a graveyard because, you know, that's where you go to commemorate people that you loved. And still graveyards are spooky because we have centuries of art and media that present us with the image of the spooky graveyard. So the idea of the uncanniness of the place being literalized in the form of the graveyard golem, that's pretty awful. Particularly if you imagine that there are like coffins and sarcophagi in the body of the golem, which could actually like disgorge skeletons or zombies. It might be a little too over the top. You have to be a little cautious with traditionally spooky images because they can sometimes have that sort of bright plastic Halloween feel to them, and then they don't quite land. Next on my list, I have Fortress Golem. Now, I certainly did not originate the idea of the Fortress Golem. I did write a scenario about it, and that was based on the images of a graphic novel, The Moving Fortress, or maybe The Mobile Fortress, with art by Enrique Alcatena. And if you like a certain type of grotesque fantasy, and you don't like the art of Alcatena, I don't know what's wrong with you. You know, he's a lot in common with kind of a lot of the great British RPG artists of the 80s. The Fortress Golem turns the golem into a location. into something that the player characters can interact with in a way other than just fighting it, that they can enter and walk around in, and yet is different from a regular castle because it has this sense of monstrousness. One of the things that really struck me about the graphic novel, even though I don't think this is present in the text at all, was I had this feeling that the fortress itself was somehow chained. And in the scenario that I wrote, the fortress golem is basically enslaved. It wanders around the land being controlled by the people who are inside it, but doesn't not necessarily what it wants. And so it has this sort of tragic feel to it that I really liked. It allowed me to get a big mobile lumbering monster into the game without it being necessarily like a mech. It gave me the ability to do some of the things you can do with mechs without adopting the tropes of like the mecha anime or of Battletech, which I don't think fit well into the D&D fantasy. And then finally, we've got the Candyman, the sugar golem that I mentioned in the Doctor Who episode. The villain Candyman in Doctor Who is, you know, based on the advertising mascot Bertie Bassett, who is, if you're not British, you probably don't know this, but he's like a little man made up of licorice all sorts. Which are brightly colored candy, right? He's basically made out of candy, and he kills people by immersing them in boiling sugar, which is super dangerous. And sugar plantations were very dangerous places in part because the refining process involved dealing with a lot of superheated sugar that was being turned into molasses, and you get burned very badly very easily. I think immersing people in boiling sugar might be going a step too far, but I like the idea that, you know, someone tried to make this guy sweet and lovable, and the result is just kind of creepy and off-putting. Because a lot of characters that adults design for the benefit of children come out creepy. And there's something about cuteness misfiring that makes it particularly horrible. There's something especially frightening about the things that are created when, you know, we fail to hit the mark of adorable. And I think all kinds of cute golems fit into that category. So that could be anything from like teddy bears to candy people to dollies, you know, all of those things that have the potential for horror because there's always that slight element of uncanniness in childhood memory. And then there's the particularly terrifying thing that happens when people try to make things cute, miss, and just overshoot into horrible. Now, I haven't mentioned mechanical differences in any of these, and I think that they're all, you know, most golems are going to fit into the lumbering brute monster category. Even the mechanically differentiated golems in the monster manual are all still some form of another of lumbering brute. I guess one of them is a rampaging brute. It kind of comes from our understanding of these inanimate materials, that they're heavy, that they're sluggish, you know, that we, thinking living beings, are quicker and more fluid than they are. And I think you probably don't want to violate that. It's like the fast zombie, you know? It's fine every once in a while, but there's a reason that death is slow but implacable. That's what most of our experiences of death are like. And I apologize that this is a gloomy image, but it is a human universal that we know that we're going to die eventually. So slow death monsters fit in with that idea. I will maybe make an exception for golems that are industrialized, mechanized creatures that are robots, because there the horror comes from the, or indeed the adventure, right? The challenge to be overcome by the hero. It's not just a horror monster. You know, the sense of the underdog comes from the idea that the human is inferior to the machine in every way. They're faster than us, they're stronger than us, they're smarter than us, they're more ruthless than us, etc. You know, but they don't understand love, or whatever it may be, right? Or they don't understand creativity, or they don't understand compassion. I mean, you know, whatever weakness is supposed to be like. They can't improvise. You tell them logic puzzles and they blow up. Something like that. But the mass robo-golem represents our fears about, like, mechanized warfare, about the idea that we have created not just a creature that is out of our control, but a system that is out of our control. And that is very much a terror of modernity. I mean, I think a lot of people in the world can look around and say, huh, I wonder if we have created a system that is out of our control. But I don't know how well it fits into the kind of pseudo-medieval setting that exists in most D&D games, because it's such a modern fear. I mean, that's not fair. In fact, I'm sure that medieval people frequently felt that the system was out of their control. I just don't know if they felt that they had created it. So a feeling of helplessness in the face of the larger world is perfectly in keeping with a medieval aesthetic, but I don't know that the idea that this is the result of human hubris is as appropriate, if that makes sense. But if you're going to have an army of clanging robo-golems, then you basically have the plot already lined out for you, right? Because presumably what that means is that there is some kind of doohickey that you must get to and turn them off, and then the mad tyrant will face you steel to steel atop his robo-factory, rather than cowering behind his armored legions. That's fine. I certainly had clanging robo-golems in my D&D game, and indeed one of them got hijacked by player characters who misled it into believing that they were its commanding officer. And it rapidly became a real problem for me because it was very tough, but I had used just a particular miniature that I had to represent him, not thinking that the PCs would steal him. And so he had like tracks, and so he couldn't go upstairs. He was a pain to get on the boat, etc., etc. So if you're going to do that, you have to have a think about what is going to happen if the player characters steal and reprogram one of them, because they are going to want to. It will be the first thing they try, and you need to have a system for that and not make it up on the fly, or else you will constantly be bothering yourself with the logistical questions of how he gets on the boat. So yeah, overall, I think we can see that golems work because they represent our anxieties about our creations, and they draw on the symbolic associations that we already have with the materials that they're made from. And if you can make those work effectively, then I think you can have some fun golems in your game. So William, I hope that you enjoyed your episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like William and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or you can pledge at another level if you prefer. Not the boss of you. In our next episode, we're gonna be taking a look at yet another indie monster collection. And I'm gonna pick out a few that I particularly enjoyed and talk about them right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.